What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, rediscovering the wilderness in women's poetry.
A thinking woman sleeps with monsters.
It was only important to smile and hold still.
The beak that grips her, she becomes.
In the 1960s, a radical change came to American poetry. Women's voices started to ring out in a medium that had been dominated by men.
For the first time in the history of writing, which is about 4,000 years or so, women could write without fear, without constantly looking over their shoulder to see if they were going to be approved of by men.
I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it.
Sylvia Plath's book, Ariel, was published in the United States in 1966.
Out of the ash, I rise with my red hair.
And it was sort of bling.
And I eat men like air.
Honesty, candor about a woman's experience, about a woman's rage.
Women have been liberated to write about anything they want to. Once women start writing about children, men do it too.
This new freedom for women poets flourished in the 1970s with the coming of age of a generation energized and inspired by predecessors such as Phyllis Wheatley, Emily Dickinson, H.D., Muriel Rukeyser, Sylvia Plath. In a series of podcasts coming out this year, we're going to look into this phenomenon, where it came from, how it developed, and its legacy today. We're calling it A Change of World, after the title of Adrienne Rich's groundbreaking first book of poems. On this, the first episode, we're going to look at some of the battles women poets fought before the modern women's movement, before the world so dramatically changed. Let's start here with Louise Bogan's poem, Women. Here's its memorable and controversial first line.
Women have no wilderness in them.
Women have no wilderness in them. Bogan wrote that in 1923, just after women had won the vote, the culmination of the first wave of feminism.
Women have no wilderness in them. They are provident instead. Content in the tight, hot cell of their hearts to eat dusty bread.
I mean, you can imagine, give me a break. What are you talking about?
Honor Moore is a poet who came of age in the 1960s and 70s during the second wave of feminism.
It infuriated us. If wilderness is a metaphor, and you're talking about Lewis and Clark charting the wilderness, that's what we were doing.
They wait when they should turn to journeys. They stiffen when they should bend.
It wasn't one of my favorite poems.
Alicia Ostreicher is a poet and critic who has written a lot about poetry by women.
Women have no wilderness in them. They suppress themselves, basically, was what it said.
So in this poem, Bogan is frustrated with how compliant and obedient women still had to be. She's looking for a world where women would not be forced to be so subservient, benevolent, and selfless.
They hear in every whisper that speaks to them a shout and a cry. As like as not, when they take life over their door sills, they should let it go by.
Alicia Ostreicher, Honor Moore, and other poets of their generation knew firsthand the unsuppressed wilderness of women poets of the 1960s and 70s, their own and others, but they also started looking further back.
If I wanted, and if we wanted, women poets to be taken seriously, we had to look at the whole tradition from the 17th century to the present. As Virginia Woolf says, we think back through our mothers if we are women.
We discovered a tradition. The tradition was there in full sight.
The female poetic tradition just wasn't taught in college or represented in anthologies yet. In fact, only the names of a few women poets were well known in the first half of the 20th century.
I mean, when I studied poetry at Harvard, there were two women poets in the course, Anne Bradstreet and Emily Dickinson. And someone like Edna St. Vincent Millay was essentially denigrated and buried, as was Amy Lowell. My image for Amy Lowell was somebody put her work in a shipping container and labeled it, Amy Lowell is a bad poet, so that nobody opened the shipping container. You know, nobody opened the shipping container of Edna St. Vincent Millay either. So there we were. There were Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and various other women who didn't get published very much, speaking, and I, a very powerful, strong female I, just a kind of permission to take from our own lives our material and make it the imagistic vehicle for our poems.
In America, poetry begins with Anne Bradstreet. She came over from England in 1630 and was the colony's first published poet, male or female. She was upper class and well-educated. Her father and husband were both governors of Massachusetts.
She wrote in a way that turned out to be typical for women for the next three centuries.
Alicia Ostreicher sees a striking pattern in the way women presented themselves in poetry from the time of Anne Bradstreet all the way up to about 1960.
A combination of rebellion and submission.
For example, says Ostreicher, in Anne Bradstreet's poem Prologue, she defiantly asserts her right as a woman to be a poet.
I am obnoxious to each carping tongue who says my hand a needle better fits.
But in the same poem, just two stanzas later, Bradstreet says,
men can do best, and women know it well. Preeminence in all and each is yours. Yet grant some small acknowledgement of ours.
That's typical of women poets for generations to come, Alicia Ostreicher says.
Being assertive and taking it back. Being submissive and then turning it around.
You can see this dynamic in another early American poet, Phyllis Wheatley. Born in West Africa, Wheatley was kidnapped when she was about six and sold into slavery in 1761 to a Boston family, the Wheatleys. She was a prodigy. She learned Greek and Latin, and at the age of 20, she published the first book of poems written by a black person in the American colonies. One of her poems is called On Being Brought from Africa to America.
It is a perfect little neoclassical poem.
From our perspective today, you would think from the title of this poem that this would be about a calamity. But in perfectly turned couplets, she begins with meek acceptance. I asked poet Camille Dungy to read it. Here's the first stanza.
'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land, taught my benighted soul to understand that there's a God, that there's a Savior, too. Once I redemption neither sought nor knew.
So she's grateful for being Christianized, thank you very much, but here's how she turns it around. It's very sly and subtle.
Some view our sable race with scornful eye. Their color is a diabolic dye. Remember, Christians, Negroes black as Cain may be refined and join the angelic train.
Camille Dungy explains just how this poem turns its own Christianity into a rational, radical argument.
She subverts it by saying, and now I can be refined. I can become an angel. And when you're thinking of Cain, which is in her poem, C-A-I-N, as in Cain and Abel, but it also suggests sugar cane, which is one of the big reasons why people were brought from West Africa to the New World. And so that idea of refinement, and you can be purified and you can be made white, which is what happens when you refine sugarcane. So she at the end of the poem says, like, I can be equal to you.
Tell me about Phyllis Wheatley in the context of African-American women poets looking back on her. How is she thought of?
The presence of this young black woman, Phyllis Wheatley, in the very beginning of the formation of America. She wrote poems for George Washington. Thomas Jefferson begrudgingly acknowledged her talent. She was a part of the fabric of what would become American literature. And so to know that I had a foremother who existed brilliantly existed was terribly important to me. There is a beautiful essay by the poet and critic June Jordan called The Difficult Miracle of Phyllis Wheatley, in which she talks about just how miraculous this human being was. And that essay was a very formative essay for its time in terms of reinvigorating the interest in Phyllis Wheatley in the 1970s and 80s.
That Negroes, black as Cain, may be refined and join the angelic train. It's that same modesty and immodesty, submission and rebellion in the same lines, the doubleness that many, many women successfully adopted.
Doubleness. Submission combined with rebellion. Alicia Oestreicher says that we can see it in Emily Dickinson a century later.
One of her best-known poems, I'm Nobody, just about the same identical time as Walt Whitman is saying, I celebrate myself, I sing myself. Emily Dickinson is saying,
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too?
You know, modest, shy, self-deprecating Emily. Then in the next stanza,
how dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog.
So in the same poem, she says, I'm nobody. And she makes fun of publicity, of the public person. And also at the same time, by bringing the you, the reader, into the poem, are you nobody too? There's a pair of us. She makes herself into the somebody whom you are following. So it's very complicated.
Dickinson could write about her deepest inner life in part because she did not seek publication for her poems. She didn't want fame. She wanted to write in private, to shield herself from the potentially silencing criticism of the outside world. But if the modest Emily Dickinson didn't excite women poets of the 1960s and 70s, there were other less shy sides to her.
Demureness was one of her games. Another was eroticism.
Wild nights, were I with thee, wild night should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee.
So that's not just sexy, it's also gender bending. I'm going to moor in you. What is that saying about the physical relationship? Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea. Don't tell me that Emily Dickinson didn't know what an orgasm was. She sure did.
And in spite of her occasional demureness, women poets of the 1970s, led by poets such as Adrienne Rich, found in Dickinson a powerful poetic woman's voice in all its wildness. Honor Moore remembers attending a reading Rich gave of her essay, Vesuvius at Home, The Power of Emily Dickinson.
She quoted Emily Dickinson, my life had stood a loaded gun. We could identify with that poem.
My life had stood a loaded gun.
I.e., I hadn't been writing poems. I had no voice.
Till a day the owner passed, identified, and carried me away.
The muse. The animus.
And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe. And every time I speak for him,
i.e. for my muse,
the mountain's straight reply
echoes back.
Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I, for I have but the power to kill without the power to die.
She is too much. I just have to read one more thing.
Yeah.
Emily Dickinson, witchcraft was hung in history, but history and I find all the witchcraft that we need around us every day.
In spite of her poetic witchcraft, Emily Dickinson published very little in her lifetime. Actually, many of her poems were first published in the 1920s, and her work didn't become widely read until the 1950s. So after Phyllis Wheatley in the late 1700s, what happened to Black women poets in the story of women asserting themselves in poetry? For Camille Dungy, there's a poem by Alice Dunbar Nelson that speaks to this predicament.
I've long been interested in the Alice Dunbar Nelson poem, I Sit and Sew, because of its apparent quaintness and frustration.
Dunbar Nelson was born in 1875 in New Orleans to mixed-race parents. Like Phyllis Wheatley, she published her first book of poems when she was only 20. But unlike Wheatley, she went on to write many more books, not only poetry, but short stories and essays. She was married briefly to the poet Paul Laurence Dunbar, a biographical detail, says Camille Dungy, that has drawn attention away from her work.
Which happens so frequently for women artists, right? That we're as interested in Frida Kahlo's love affairs as we're interested in her art. And that seems to be the case frequently with Alice Dunbar Nelson when people write about and think about her.
In 1918, while hundreds of thousands of American men were fighting in World War I, Dunbar Nelson wrote a poem called I Sit and Sew.
This poem is very much about what it means to be a woman who is constrained by the circumstances of gender inequity.
The poem bears comparison with the war poetry of the period, but from the far distance of enforced domesticity. Here's the second stanza.
I sit and sew. My heart aches with desire. That pageant terrible, that fiercely pouring fire on wasted fields and writhing grotesque things, once men. My soul in pity flings appealing cries, yearning only to go there in that holocaust of hell, those fields of woe. But I must sit and sew.
She wants to be on the battlefield doing something, not just fixing this pretty seam, right? She wants to be sewing up bodies, sewing up world order, active.
Notice that that stanza, the whole poem, in fact, says nothing about race.
For writers of color, very frequently there's a sense like, oh, well, now you're a Black woman writer, and now you're always right about Black woman things, right? Whereas this poem by Alice Dunbar Nelson is saying, I'm a woman, and I'm writing about what it means to be set aside from the theater of war and of life. That is a common thread that she has with other women in that moment.
So as June Jordan and other African-American women poets of the 60s and 70s are looking back on the tradition, what's different for the Black women of that generation, and your generation for that matter, looking back on history as opposed to white women? Seems like race adds a complexity to it that I'm trying to get at.
Well, so one of the things that becomes different for me as a writer of color when I look back at the history of women writers is that in the way that women look and say, oh, there's Anne Bradstreet, I can pull Anne Bradstreet up again. We can reclaim Emily Dickinson's poems as Emily Dickinson intended those poems to be presented, as opposed to these prettified things that showed up at first, right? That we can claim these women writers and understand this really interesting, poetically charged literary heritage that I'm a part of. But if I just name Anne Bradstreet and Emily Dickinson, whose work I love and admire, I'm missing a part of my own heritage, right? I'm missing a part of my story. And so bringing poets like Phyllis Wheatley and Alice Dunbar Nelson into that tradition allows me to see another part of me that is very real and true and important.
I knew you had gone. I do not mean the long road to Hades, not so long.
I knew too that through them, I knew too that he was through.
Some women poets in the early decades of the 20th century became players in the avant-garde movements of literary modernism. I give you Gertrude Stein.
If they tear a hunter through, if they tear through a hunter, if they tear through a hunt and a hunter, if they tear through the different sizes of the six.
But how does a modernist poet like Gertrude Stein fit into the story of women poets finding their voices as women?
I don't think she fits in. What she fits into is the experimentation of modernism.
A blue coat and black garters and a plaid cap, a fourth a knife grinder who is full-faced, and a very little woman with black hair. And a young
modernism for women meant that you didn't write about your feelings at all, or at least not openly. You wrote abstractly, you wrote playfully, you wrote experimentally. You did interesting new things with form, like Marianne Moore and Gertrude Stein, to try and get the approval of the boys' club. You had to write like the boys and not write about domesticity, not write about romance, not weep, that kind of thing.
Nonetheless, the achievements of modernist women poets were huge. Honor Moore says that for her generation, they were something of a discovery in the 1960s and 70s.
H.D., the pen name for Hilda Doolittle, who was a contemporary of Pound and whom Pound championed, you've read her short lyrics, her imagist poems, and then you find out that she has several book-length poems, trilogy, Helen in Egypt.
Are you spirit? Are you sister? Are you brother? Are you alive? Are you dead?
You know, she's not a mere lyric poet. Trilogy has the kind of power and ambition of The Wasteland and the Cantos, you know, but it's by a woman, so nobody, that long poem Trilogy. So it really took not only sort of digging out these poems and sort of liberating them from the dust heap, from the back shelves of the library. We continually had the attitude that the strong, powerful poems by women were being suppressed, and we were meant to find them.
There were two poets coming out of late modernism that they didn't need to dust off because they were still very much alive, and they were models for how women could inhabit their own poems.
This is Gwendolyn Brooks, January 19th, 1961, reading from my own poems.
I think submission is not the word that I would ever use with Gwendolyn Brooks.
From a street in Bronzeville, kitchenette building.
She presents the world that she sees out of her window and in her movements through her South Side Chicago neighborhood as givens.
But could a dream send up through onion fumes its white and violet? Fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall. Flutter or sing an aria down these rooms.
Another poet who was very influential with younger poets like Adrienne Rich was Muriel Rukeyser.
On second cry, I woke fully and gave to feed and fed on feeding.
Rukeyser's example of speaking out personally and politically gave courage to younger women poets as they began to take stock of the breadth and depth of the female poetic tradition.
The line, no more masks, no more mythologies, no more masks becomes the title of a best-selling anthology of women's poetry. She wrote, if one woman told the truth about her life, the world would split open. The World Would Split Open became the title of another anthology.
Alicia Ostreicher. We also heard from Honor Moore and Camille Dungy. Our reader was Cindy Katz. This has been the first episode of our series, A Change of World. We'll be back soon with another episode about some of the landmark books of women's poetry in the 1950s and 60s. Do let us know what you think of this podcast and of this series in particular. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can link to the podcast on social media from SoundCloud, or you can subscribe to it in iTunes. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. for Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.